With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. U.S. officials are protesting Mexico's move to ban genetically modified corn. Well, United States Trade Representative Catherine Tai and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack are contesting Mexico's move to largely ban imports of genetically modified corn from the U.S. Tai said the U.S. has, quote, repeatedly conveyed its concerns that Mexico's biotechnology policies are not based on science and threaten to disrupt U.S. exports to Mexico to the detriment of agricultural producers. Vilsack called for fair, open, science and rule-based trade. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is seeking to phase out genetically modified corn by 2024. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. CDFA awards $4.1 million for climate-smart livestock projects. The California Department of Food and Agriculture is funding three research projects under the California Livestock Methane Management, Mitigation, and Thriving Environment Research Grant Program. CDFA Secretary Karen Ross says, quote, this funding will help ensure that California continues to see emission benefits from ongoing projects and achieve additional reductions from the new practices that address enteric methane and turn manure into useful products. She adds, we're excited about these proposals from our grantees and look forward to seeing their innovative work. The research project's goals are threefold and include $1.6 million to verify the greenhouse gas and environmental co-benefits of climate-smart practices on California dairies, $500,000 to evaluate alternative methane mitigation strategies, including those that add enteric methane, and $2 million to advance manure recycling and innovative product development. To learn more about the projects and the program, visit cdfa.ca.gov. And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
Producers have further opportunity to participate in the LandFlex grant program. Almond Alliance CEO Aubrey Betancourt said that eligibility for the program is set to expand.
The program rolled out as a pilot with Department of Water Resources months ago, with three critically overdrafted basins that recently just closed. And so the next round of LandFlex should be opening on June 14th, and it will be opening now to four more districts and basins. So we're looking at Pixley Irrigation District, Lower Tule Irrigation District, Mid-Cahuilla GSA, and Westlands Water District. We're excited to see how this works out because a lot of this is going to be in areas that are dealing with a lot of flood protection and flood mitigation issues. So again, LandFlex is providing incentive and tools for farmers in these areas to facilitate groundwater recharge and flood mitigation.
The Ag Team Professional Development Project in Marin County helped foster better understanding of farming issues within the local community. Sustainable Ag Coordinator and Agricultural Ombuds for Marin County Cooperative Extension, Vince Trotter, said a central feature of the project was building a connection between agriculture and county leadership, which included 21 members across eight different departments.
One of the really critical pieces that helped to open the door for this program is how the county was able to see agriculture's survival and agriculture's success as being essential to the county's broad goals. In other words, you know, the success of our farmers and ranchers isn't just important to the farmers and ranchers, it's important to the county as a whole. And so, you know, I think when leadership within the county could see that there were areas that were of critical importance to county leadership were present within the ag community, it started to make sense that they needed to really apply themselves to working in close partnership with the farming community. And so I think that was kind of a critical gateway into this work.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, the Senate Ag Subcommittee on Food and Nutrition, Specialty Crops, Organics, and Research held a hearing June 7th on how the Farm Bill works for specialty crop producers. The Vice President of U.S. Government Relations at the International Fresh Produce Association, Rebecca Adcock, was in attendance, and I talked with her after the hearing. Here is part of our conversation. This is such an important topic for our specialty crop producers because they don't have much of a part in the Farm Bill. And in fact, for many, many years, they weren't included at all. So what if you could have your highest goal for the Farm Bill and specialty crops, what would that be?
The highest goal would be to increase the federal investment in the Farm Bill. Specialty crops are 44% of the crop farm gate for the U.S., but we're down in the nearly single digits on Farm Bill spending proportionate to all the other parts of agriculture. And all parts of agriculture are important, but since USDA says fruits and vegetables and all those products that we are most familiar with seeing on our plate should be half our plate, we think that the federal government should up the investment that they make in the specialty crop industry.
And that was a statistic or a number, that I heard today during the hearing. In fact, from the IFPA representative who was speaking today, he said, it's specialty crops, 44% of the agricultural value in the U.S. And I think he said 3.5% of the Farm Bill.
That is on direct spending. Yeah. So if you compare, for example, Title I with Title X, which are a comparison between your traditional row crops and specialty crops, the spending there is very disproportionate. And so you get into the way above 50% on Title I and down in the below 4% on Title X.
You know, I know that you probably don't have an answer to this, but, as a reporter, my first question is why? Why this way? But it's been this way.
Well, so from Congress's perspective, the Farm Bill having direct programs designed specifically for specialty crops, not all the things that are general farm applicable, but the specialty crop targeted programs like the Specialty Crop Research Initiative, the Specialty Crop Block Grants that go to the states, some of the work that is done in the trade space, those things have really only been around since 2008. So we are ramping up. But we are reaching a level of maturity, even for the history of the Farm Bill, that we believe that it's time, and we've more than made the case and more than seen a tremendous amount of benefit and support and some growth, at least we'd like to see more, for the specialty crop industry through the opportunities that are afforded in the Farm Bill. And pretty much every program out there designed for specialty crops is overprescribed, in our opinion, underfunded, and most of them have not seen a plus-up or additional funds in the last at least 1 to 2 cycles of Farm Bill reauthorization that every 5 years that has to be redone and rebooted. And we think there's more than enough evidence and more than enough justification to bring those programs better into fiscal alignment.
To hear more of what Adcock had to say about specialty crops in the Farm Bill, you can download this week's AgNet Weekly. The AgNet Weekly is available on our website, agnetwest.com, or through your favorite podcast listening app. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's Livestock Report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's Livestock News, we recently told you how ag groups across the country applauded the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in the Sackett versus EPA case. The court said wetlands under the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act must have a continuous surface connection with that water, thus making it difficult to determine where the water ends and the wetland begins. The National Cattlemen's Beef Association has worked on this issue for many years, and NCBA Chief Counsel Mary Thomas Hart looks back at what the association has done to help producers across the country on the WOTUS matter.
We would be here all day if I recapped everything, but I'll try to give you kind of a high-level overview. So it really started back in 2013 when the Obama administration started writing their what would be the 2015 Clean Water Rule, or the WOTUS definition. NCBA participated in the rulemaking process. When that rule was finalized, we went to court and sued the Obama administration over that rule. Two federal district courts found in our favor in those cases. But the Trump administration was then elected into office, and they pulled back the Obama rule and wrote their own replacement definition. That's a rule that we defended in court, in federal court. And then the Biden administration kind of ran the same playbook. So they came into office, pulled back the Trump rule, and in 2023 finalized their definition. So in the last 8 years, we've had three different regulatory definitions of WOTUS, really all hinging on how to apply the significant nexus test. That's something that this court recognized, highlighted in their opinion, you know, the back and forth between administrations. And I think in pulling back the significant nexus test really hopes to provide both regulators and regulated stakeholders more regulatory certainty.
Now, many are calling on the EPA to quickly update the WOTUS regulation according to the ruling that was issued by the Supreme Court. Again, if you'd like to learn more about all of this, go to the National Cattlemen's Beef Association website, ncba.org. And a reminder, the 59th World Livestock Auctioneer Championship, or WLAC, set to take place today and tomorrow. It's being held in conjunction with the Livestock Marketing Association's annual convention. It runs through tomorrow in Florida. 31 semifinalist auctioneers will be competing in the competition. The auctioneering contest begins with the interview portion. That will take place today. That's where each WLAC semifinalist must clearly establish and demonstrate their knowledge of the livestock marketing industry. The second part of the competition will then take place Saturday at a live sale. That's where contestants will sell cattle to actual bidders in the seats. Now, you can view all of this via online broadcast. The interviews can be seen this afternoon starting at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. The auctioneering competition will start at 8 a.m. Saturday Eastern Time. To learn more, go to the Livestock Marketing Association website, lmaweb.com. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination,
our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A little relief at the grocery store. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. After 2 years of climbing grocery bills, things are starting to cool off.
In April, grocery inflation on a three-month annualized basis, which is just saying, if the 3 months we're looking at stayed that way all year, inflation was actually negative.
Joelle Gamble, Deputy Director of the National Economic Council, says there may be more relief to come.
We do expect grocery inflation to continue to improve along overall inflation, headline inflation, though it's likely to remain elevated compared to where it was before the pandemic through the rest of the year.
Gamble points out grocery inflation is a sample of how things are overall.
And so when grocery inflation starts to cool, that means overall inflation could be impacted in a positive way.
She said the decline in agricultural inputs is helping to bring the food costs down. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough. Sometimes errors are made in real estate deeds involving conveyances of farm and ranch land. The mistake might be a minor one that goes uncorrected, or it could be a significant one that means potentially thousands of dollars in lost acres or access rights. Is there a way to fix the error after it has occurred? One of the core principles of contract law is fairness. In a case in 1615, King James is quoted as saying, "Where common law and equity conflict, equity should prevail." In the realm of contracts, what the king was saying is that when an agreement has been entered into, but the written form does not express what the parties actually intended, a court should reform the writing so that it conforms to the party's intent. Of course, the evidence must sufficiently disclose the party's intent and that the instrument as written doesn't carry out that intent. In a recent Iowa case involving a farm, an error by a title company caused the warranty deed to not match the description in the purchase agreement. Ultimately, the court said that there was sufficient evidence of the party's intent so that the court could reform the deed to match up the legal descriptions. There are many court decisions where reformation of written instruments has been allowed as a remedy on the ground of mutual mistake. Equity is an old legal doctrine that still applies in contract law today. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough.
Every Monday afternoon, the Agriculture Department releases what is called a Crop Progress Report. You may get the highlights of it on this radio station, in fact. It gives the condition of various crops, where they are in their development, how much has been planted and harvested. It's done by state and then on a national scale. And you can imagine,
it is getting a lot of attention.
Lance Honig with the USDA Statistics Service. Of course, farmers and traders are all wondering every week what this report will show. Honig says farmers and the markets rely on this report. And getting the local reports for this national assessment every week, that's a huge undertaking.
We actually have about 4,000 reporters that we contact each week to fill out these reports. Our goal is to have a report for every county in the United States. Now, obviously, every week we don't have every single county covered, but we've got, like most of our surveys, we shoot for about 80% coverage each week.
The assessments are done by folks like county extension agents, farm service agency people, and others. They, of course, go out and look at crops and check on planting progress and emergence. And later on in the session, the condition of the crops.
And they're also in contact with producers in their area. They're spending time traveling around their county during the week. So it's based on not only firsthand observations, but they are also, in many cases, getting input from the producers themselves.
Now, of course, tracking how much crops been planted, that's a pretty straightforward job, but a lot of what they gather is subjective later on when it gets to the condition of the crop and how it's changed from the past week. But
we do give them very specific direction and guidelines as to how they're to report, how the different stages are defined and things of that nature. So even though they're subjective reports, they're based on standardized definitions.
And then every Monday morning, they send in those reports to USDA headquarters, thousands of reports.
And we've got an individual in here who works very feverishly throughout the afternoon to compile all that data and to get that report together to be released at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Happens week in and week out.
And so farmers and grain traders and many others will be anxiously awaiting this next Monday when USDA will once again give us the latest national snapshot of the crop situation and the condition of the nation's rangelands and pastures. Monday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 Central. In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Many crops depend on healthy pollinators. From beetles to flies, hummingbirds, bats, and bees, pollinators are essential in helping turn pollen into food. June 19th through 25th is National Pollinator Week, reminding us of the key role pollinators play in preserving natural habitats and producing successful crops. This message is brought to you by Syngenta, committed to protecting the safety and health of pollinators that feed and fuel the world.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Today's USDA crop report will likely be a non-factor for corn and soybeans, but could get the attention of the wheat trade. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report to end the week, brought to you by Superior Livestock. Bottom line grain analysts see little fresh news for corn and soybeans in today's supply-demand update, but there will be new estimates for the wheat crop here and worldwide, and even more impactful demand estimates. We see old crop U.S. ending wheat stocks increasing again, over 605 million would be our number, and new crop ending stocks up as well, over 565 million bushels both, keeping pressure on futures. July Kansas City wheat should find resistance anywhere above $8.802 in our view, as they did yesterday. Corn and soybeans, all about weekend rain. This is the bottom line report. We look for August live cattle today to hold yesterday's low, 172.45, and August feeder cattle holding yesterday's low, 238.80. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
The Japanese ban on fresh potatoes from the U.S. continues, but work on lifting that ban also is continuing.
I had discussions, very positive discussions, with our partners in the Japanese government this week, and we're going to continue to engage and make progress, I think, on this issue.
Undersecretary of Agriculture for Trade Alexis Taylor just back from leading a U.S. ag trade mission in Japan this week, a mission partly to sell more U.S. food and ag products, also to keep discussions going about the potato issue.
These are technical discussions around pest risk and the mitigation measures to pests of concern for Japan from the United States. And so we continue to have really productive technical discussions and also positive discussions at the political level.
Which Taylor believes will lead to Japan allowing U.S. potatoes to be sold in that country as a fresh product, not just for making chips. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And a specialty crop farmer from Indiana told the Senate Agriculture Committee small farms need better access to crop insurance in the next farm bill. Here's Michael Clements with a report.
Small farms growing specialty crops face challenges when it comes to crop insurance. Nick Carter, Indiana Farm Bureau member and owner of Mud Creek Farm, shared the importance of small farms with the Senate Agriculture Committee Wednesday.
It was a great opportunity to be able to share with the Ag Committee that the Farm Bill has opportunities to make federal programs more accessible and more beneficial to small diversified agriculture. For example, crop insurance fairly inaccessible to small farmers. The same with a lot of the grant programs that have become pretty onerous to apply for and manage. But small farms have a huge impact on local economies, rural economies, and they need to be focused on.
Carter says specialty crop growers need improved access to crop insurance.
Specialty crops are some of the riskiest crops to put out. They're far more sensitive to changes in weather patterns and just climate issues. If you're putting out specialty crops like lettuce, tomatoes, cucumbers, any of the foods that we eat on our plate, it's very difficult to get crop insurance that's meaningful, actually mitigates the risk of putting it out. And so as a result, I think we're seeing fewer farmers willing to convert into growing specialty crop from row crop because the risks are just insurmountable.
Carter says it is important that all farmers and ranchers share their farm bill priorities with elected officials, not just those growing specialty crops or running small farms.
Real farmers have got to be here in D.C. making our voices heard. The people in that committee are not farmers themselves. They've never grown food. They haven't delivered a baby calf. They've never collected eggs and sold them on the market. So they've got to understand what it's like for their constituents who are feeding America.
Michael Clements, Washington.
There's a new CEO for the NMPF. The National Milk Producers Federation Board of Directors unanimously voted to name Greg Dowd as its next president and CEO. Dowd will follow Jim Mulhern, who announced his retirement at the end of the year earlier this week. NMPF Board Chairman Randy Mooney says dairy farmers across the nation are pleased to endorse a true champion of agriculture. Dowd has served in numerous leadership roles in trade associations and government work in his more than 30-year career in agricultural policy and economics, most recently at Aimpoint Research. From 2018 to 2021, he served as chief agricultural negotiator for the U.S. Office of the Trade Representative. Dowd will begin official work at NMPF in September as its chief operating officer before assuming the role of president and CEO upon Mulhern's retirement. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNetWest.
A landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing.
It was that pre-recorded announcement by General Dwight D. Eisenhower, June 6, 1944, that let the public know about D-Day and what was happening at that moment on the shores of Normandy.
Heavy firing now just behind us, and anti-aircraft burst in the sky.
155,000 troops landing on the beaches, troops who had an edge not only in weapons but also in food and nutrition, an edge that helped make D-Day successful.
Certainly, if you have to deal with just getting food to your troops, they're not going to have the same level of energy or ability to withstand the stresses and trials of an invasion like that.
In fact, Agriculture Department historical expert Ann Efland says the edge in food played a critical role in the entire U.S. war effort. In fact, 30 months before D-Day, just after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt told American farmers,
"You have a most grave responsibility to the nation now and for the duration of this war."
Ann Efland says the country's farmers made valiant efforts to boost food production for the war effort, working against tough conditions.
There were restrictions on use of rubber and steel, which affected use of farm machinery. So there was a lot of effort to help farmers understand how to better repair machinery that they already had, to share machinery around different regions to be sure there was enough.
But the biggest shortage was labor. Many of the nation's farmers were being drafted into the army.
So there were efforts to mobilize women, rural women, and bring in women from urban areas to mobilize high school boys and girls to work on the farms.
And efforts to guide farmers to grow things better suited for wartime.
Oil seed crops, for example, that could be good livestock feed and provide oil, which was also could be used for industrial purposes to overcome some of our shortage of oil, because that's a heavily used material for the armed forces.
Meanwhile, food was rationed in this country, and civilians everywhere were urged to plant victory gardens to supplement their food supply. This allowed President Roosevelt to tell the nation that because of all these efforts, particularly on the parts of farmers,
"There is enough food today for all of us, and enough left over to send to those who are fighting with us."
And Ann Efland says it made those troops
ready to fight, ready to produce, ready to do whatever was needed because they were well fed.
And that contributed to the success of D-Day. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
We want everyone to breathe clean, healthy air, but California's traffic and mountains don't make it easy. Our mountains trap pollution, making us more vulnerable to dirty air. Today's farmers are voluntarily doing their part with help from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. How? By replacing older diesel-powered tractors and equipment, treating dusty farm roads, avoiding open burning, and more. Can't afford it? NRCS has invested $178 million helping California farmers clean our air. They can help you too. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Earlier in the show, we heard a report on the LandFlex program opening up to four more irrigation districts. Here's AgNet West Brian Dermott with a more in-depth interview on this topic.
Almond Alliance CEO Aubrey Betancourt joins us this morning to talk a bit about some news with the LandFlex grant program. And now, Aubrey, we've talked about this a couple times here as it's been developed and rolled out. But for those that don't know, let's just start with a recap of what the LandFlex program does, and then we can get into what the latest development is here.
Sure. LandFlex is a program that was designed with the Department of Water Resources as a program and a new tool in the toolkit for our farmers as well as our rural communities to do two things. One is to first and foremost protect at-risk rural water systems and wells, which of course is a primary objective of ultimately, which is part two, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, and achieving sustainability with our aquifers. And so the second part of LandFlex is a tool to help our farmers transition to sustainability and to provide financial certainty as well as regulatory certainty as they make that transition. So it's a tool in the toolkit for the farmer that works in drought and as it was designed to immediately stop the bleed and protect our at-risk well systems by enrolling in a one-year contract to stop or halt or suspend well pumping next to at-risk water systems. And then in a flood year, as we're finding out, the program actually is in living up to its name and its flexibility and becoming an incentive and a mechanism by which to allow farmers to utilize their land as part of the solution for flood protection and mitigation and aquifer recharge. In both scenarios, whether in a drought or in a flood, LandFlex is a program where the farmer and the farmer's land becomes part of the ultimate solution for achieving healthy, sustainable watersheds in our most critical basins around the state. The program rolled out as a pilot with Department of Water Resources a couple weeks ago, months ago, with three critically overdrafted basins that recently just closed. I'm not at liberty to share numbers just yet, but I'll tell you, it really is remarkable how well this program calculates true wet water savings in the basin and provides that certainty and stability financially and regulatorily for our farmers. And it keeps that land farming. LandFlex is a tool in the toolkit combined with a number of other programs, but this one really subscribes to the idea that we can transition our farms and our land into sustainability with the flexibility for different climate conditions, different hydraulic conditions, without needing to permanently put farms out of business. Farmers can be a part of the solution for SGMA compliance and for achieving groundwater sustainability health. And so the next round of LandFlex has been announced. It should be opening on June 14th, and it will be opening now to four more districts and basins. We're excited to see how this works out because a lot of this is going to be in areas that are dealing with a lot of flood protection and flood mitigation issues. So again, LandFlex is providing incentive and tools for farmers in these areas to facilitate groundwater recharge and flood mitigation. And again, it creates really a nomenclature for us to track very accurately wet water benefit to these critically overdrafted basins and to our farmers as well.
And for this latest round of opening up to other basins, what are the four new ones that are now going to be kind of included in this program availability there?
Sure. So we're looking at Pixley Irrigation District, Lower Tule Irrigation District, Mid-Cahuilla GSA, and Westlands Water District.
And a question of funding for the program. I know that the state is now not really in a great budgetary place, but there is some work going on to try and ensure that this program, because it's being pretty well received, it sounds like, that there is still continued and ongoing support for this moving forward, right?
Yeah, there really is. The tool is, again, it's unfortunate the budget position that we're in, but the tool is proving to work and work very well. Like we said, it was designed in a drought, in an extreme drought, and it's proving to be very effective in a flood. So in many ways, we as the technical assistance providers on contract with the program, along with our fellow technical assistance providers, Western United Dairies and others, and the department are very pleased with the outcome, and we want to continue to see the program moving forward. So we are in the middle, you know, we have a few days left in the budget negotiations with the state. And there's, we think there's opportunity, hopefully, to negotiate some flexibility and make our case with folks to continue to fund the program because it is effective. And compared to other tools that are out there that help more at a regional level, this is the only SGMA compliance tool that's focused specifically on the farmer. And to my knowledge, it is the fastest to be deployed. We have resources and dollars on the landscape within 45 days compared to programs that are still pending for their funding to be released that were approved over a year ago. So in terms of rapid fire response and new tools in the toolkit to solve one of the greatest problems in California water resilience, which is sustainable aquifers, We think LandFlex is proving itself very well. Timing is critical, like I said, with budget negotiations taking place right now. But we're all supportive of the program. We think it speaks for itself as these numbers are going to start rolling out here, I think, in the next few days. And we're going to go to bat for what we think is a good tool for our farmers that we're just scratching the surface for what it could do.
Lastly here, just want to give kind of a plug for where people can go to get some more information, maybe sign up or just kind of learn what this is about and things of that nature.
Absolutely. So go to landflex.org. There you'll find all of the specific information about the program itself, links to the Department of Water Resources program page on it, also links for application. It's really important for farmers, if you're even thinking about if this program works for you, or you want to explore if it works for you, go ahead and apply if you are in a GSA that's been selected. There is no penalty for applying, and there is no penalty for withdrawing an application. The application is how you get to start the conversation. It allows us as the technical assistance providers to then sit down and work with you, look at your overall portfolio, look at your farm plan, look at your farm itself, and see if this program is right for you and what's the best way to apply it for you. The program is truly a flexible tool, as the name implies. So go ahead and submit an application so that we can start talking with you. That honestly is the best way to participate in this, is even if you just have a slight suspicion this might be useful for you, go ahead and apply. There is no penalty for application. There is no penalty for withdrawing an application. It's a totally risk-free application process, but that allows us as technical assistance providers to start working with you and see if it is going to work for you and really maximize the program for you if it does.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. The Office of Small Farms Establishment Act introduced in the House and the Senate. New legislation introduced this week would increase support for farmers, ranchers, and foresters with small acreage operations across the country. The Office of Small Farms Establishment Act would create a new office within USDA. The office would ensure that small acreage operations have equitable access to the critical federal programs that provide farm loans, conservation funding, and crop insurance. New Jersey Democrat Cory Booker introduced the bill in the Senate, and Democrat Representatives Marilyn Strickland of Washington, Alma Adams of North Carolina, and Jim McGovern introduced the bill in the House. Small farms are essential to local and regional food supply chains, bolstering rural economic vitality, food security, and community resilience, according to the lawmakers. Although they only cover 8% of agricultural land, they are responsible for 20% of all agricultural sales. American Farmland Trust supports the legislation, as a spokesperson for the organization says, this bill is really about ensuring equitable access to the full range of essential support for farmers. USDA classifies small family farms with a gross cash farm income of less than $350,000. According to data from the 2017 Census of Agriculture, there was more than 1.7 million small family farms across the nation. NAFB contributed to that report.
Projects designed to rebuild infrastructure after damage from hurricanes, flooding, and other forms of extreme weather. The focus of a recent funding announcement by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service.
USDA is investing over $265 million through the EWP and infrastructure projects in 16 states impacted by extreme weather events.
Astrid Martinez of NRCS says examples of emergency watershed protection projects include repair of damages caused by hurricanes Ian and Fiona in Florida and Puerto Rico, respectively, as well as
California NRCS is working with local project sponsors to develop proposed projects and cost estimates for recent flooding events in California.
In addition, up to $135 million in financial assistance is available through EWP buyouts for property within limited resource areas impacted by constant flooding. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Individuals and organizations who provide technical assistance for organic production and marketing are being asked to participate in a nationwide study. New York University and the National Center for Appropriate Technology are hosting an online survey looking for organic industry input. The project partners will use the study results to examine current practices and develop national-level recommendations regarding technical assistance for organic production and marketing. NCAT's Appropriate Technology Transfer for Rural Areas program will publish and promote the recommendations. The online questionnaire should only take approximately 10 minutes to complete. The study can be found at surveymonkey.com/r/organic-TA-survey. Those interested will have until Monday, June 12th to participate in the study. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media, at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.